Thank you, everybody. So we're so happy to be with you again today and reflect together with our faith traditions. Let me turn this on. Okay, we're so happy to be with all of you today. And our microphone is working. Thanks to Jonah, who is like a soldering genius this morning. Uh-huh. And so during our sessions this week, we're reflecting on the economy, the environment, and when people are othered. And so the Tracy Levine Center, which I'm the executive director of, is all about bridging bias and building unity through multi-faith peacemaking. And we have a TV show that we do. It's on MeTV on Sunday mornings at 7:30, but it's also on the web. You can find information over there. And last year, Adam Yohanna and Adam and I were here, and Carol Jensen was here, part of the Faith Action Network. And as we were reflecting on that last year, we thought, you know, we've got to like add more of an action element to this. You know, so I always think it's better to do multi-faith kind of conversation around real issues.
Yeah.
But like that still is not enough. Like we got to figure out like what shared values we have and then what we can do about it in partnership together, which I often say to my Christian sisters and brothers who are in leadership, that when a faith community does work on its own, it is most often perceived as a marketing ploy.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a homeless shelter thing, that's a marketing ploy. When we do it with ecumenical and interreligious partners, all of a sudden the larger culture says, hey, wow, they might actually believe it, instead of just thinking about us recruiting or doing our team versus their team kind of stuff. And so we're really happy to be here with the Faith Action Network today. We have Amber Dickinson, who's the community organizing specialist of the Faith Action Network, and also Carol Jensen, you've been on the board like for a long time.
I'm the co-chair and sort of one of the co-founders of FAN, so since the beginning.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Let's give Carol a round of applause.
Yeah.
And then later in the week after, so what's going to happen today is we're going to talk about through the week these three questions. How do we envision the proper goals of an economic system? How do we envision our responsibility within the environment? And envision our responsibility to the other. And of course, the other is in quotes because we're all part of one humanity. So our schedule today is a brief introduction to the challenge, which Adam's going to give. And then a time for each of the three to reflect on that from our own faith tradition. We're going to respond to each other. We'll do some Q&A. And then we're going to have interaction led by Carol and Amber to help us like begin to think through like what are some of the practical issues that are happening in the world with respect to the environment that we might want to do differently. We might want to get moving. So that's the way it'll go today. And of course, our issue today is about the environment. And so we're going to start off with having Adam give us an introduction to the topic.
Hello, everyone, and good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Adam Jamal. I am an imam in Redmond, Washington. So here's my intro to this discussion. A former United States Secretary of the Interior said that stewardship of the environment is not really an urgent matter in light of the prophesied destruction of the natural order on doomsday. In this era, we have become so disconnected from nature that we don't realize we are causing a destruction. And when the signs of our destruction are laid out in front of us, we either deny them or wave them away. As practitioners of faith, many times it is easy to revert back to the comfortable ethics and morality of agreed upon issues like murder and theft, but the faithful must dig deeper to find the solutions to the problems of today. Iranian-American philosopher Sayyid Hussein Nasser says, the environmental crisis is fundamentally a crisis of values, and that religions being a primary source of values in any culture are thus implicated in the decisions humans make regarding the environment. Pope Francis also observes that solutions cannot come from science and technology alone, as by 2050, over 60% of the world's population will be either Muslim or Christian. So what guidance do the Abrahamic faiths provide to the current and coming generations regarding these key issues of today? And how can religion inform us with the values that we need to reverse the ecological and environmental damage that we have caused to our planet?
Rabbi, you want to fascinate me? The environment in your spot. So before we get started, I just want to say that I've been thinking about the environment in Jewish life a lot recently, because part of what's being called upon us as human beings right now is to change our ways, to change how we live. And I've been reflecting on the fact that for thousands of years, Jews just haven't been eating pork. Like, we just don't. You know, I mean, a lot of Jews do, but a lot of Jews do not, also. A lot of Reform Jews, people in my congregation who don't keep the dietary laws, might just not eat pork. Like, we just don't. And I thought, well, if we've had the ability to just not consume something that's very available in our culture, what does that mean in terms of our future? Could we just decide, as a people, we're not using disposable plastic? We're just not. Like, we just, it's like, it's trafe, it's pork, it's, we don't do it, we just don't do it. And that's the kind of resolve that we need as human beings, is that sort of, it's kosher, not kosher way of living, in terms of, I'm just not going to use that because that's not kosher for me. And the whole point of kashrut from the very beginning of the dietary laws was an awareness of consumption. What am I putting in my body and how is it related to the divine? How is it related to the whole? And while pork might not be the issue du jour of human civilization, we are looking at the collapse of our environment because of our consumption practices. And that level of legality and rigidity, I think, could be very helpful to human populations at this time. So in Genesis, in Bereishit, we have the story that God takes Adam and puts him in the garden and says, you're here to till and to guard it. So in our tradition, our collective tradition, the role of humanity, we have like one major job, and that's to protect the earth, and we're not doing a very good job. We're very good at the working it. We've worked it within an inch of its existence, but we have not been very good at the guarding portion of it. In Vayikra and Leviticus, we learn that the land must not be sold forever because it doesn't belong to anyone. It belongs to God, ultimately, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and residents with me. Throughout the land you possess, you must provide redemption of the land. So we are in sacred relationship with the land through the divine, and we have a special relationship to guard it and to preserve it. From Midrash on Kohelet Rabbah, upon creating the first human being, God guided them around the Garden of Eden, saying, look at my creation. See how beautiful and perfect they are. I created everything for you. Make sure you don't ruin or destroy my world, for if you do, there will be no one to fix it. So that sense of entitlement that we have as human beings, that this is all for us, I mean, we definitely get those messages from the Bible, but we equally get the message that you're here to maintain, preserve, and protect it. It's almost as they knew that our fall as humanity would be destroying the very land that we live upon. And in Genesis, and the Lord, whoops, that's not what I wanted.
That was my fault.
From Bereishit Rabbah, this is Midrash, which we learned a lot about in the last hour on Genesis. The rabbi said, even though you may think superfluous in the world things such as fleas and gnats and flies and mosquitoes, even they are included in creation of the world. The Holy One has a purpose for everything, including snakes, scorpions, gnats, and frogs. So every single thing has its purpose and its place. And as human beings, we think we understand a lot about the way the world works. But as scientists discover each and every day a new connection of something that we didn't know about or notice that is actually so important to the functioning of the whole. And this is something that science has slowly been revealing to human beings, but it's a spiritual reality that's been presented to us from the beginning. The Midrash on Sifra, if it were not for the trees, human life could not exist. We knew that spiritually before we knew it scientifically. And Tani, there's a beautiful story that I love so much. You might have heard it before. Once Honi, random guy, was walking along the road when he saw a man planting a carob tree. Honi asked, "How long before it will bear fruit?" And the man answered, 70 years. Honi asked, "Are you sure you'll be here in 70 years to eat that fruit?" And the man replied, "I found the world filled with carob trees, just as my ancestors planted for me, so I will plant for my children." Now, we know, and it's terrifying, and I don't know if you have any millennials or Gen Zers in your family, but I do, my children, and their thoughts about the future are quite grim. Because when they read and hear in the newspaper, 15 years till the planet's going to collapse, what do you make of your own life? What do you make of your own life when you constantly are hearing messages that the planet's going to collapse, and you look at the adults and the people in charge around you, and they're not freaking out? What messages are we giving children? And so when we plant trees and when we work for the care of the environment, we're letting children know we want there to be a planet for you. But that emptiness and the addiction and the suicide and the self-harm and all the things that we're seeing at such alarming rates among youth, I truly believe it's connected to our lack of vocal and action as adults in affirming for them that we want a planet to be here for you in the future. We're the honies who don't understand yet that we have to create the future. From Talmud, this is from the Talmud from Shabbat, "And all that God created in this world, the Holy One did not create a single thing without a purpose." Again, thus the snail is a remedy for a scab, and the fly is an antidote for a hornet's sting, and the mosquito crushed up for a snake bite, and the snake can cure certain types of boils, and the spider as a remedy for scorpion sting. And this is from Maimonides, so this is a medieval text. "It is forbidden to cut down fruit-bearing trees outside a besieged city, nor may a water channel be deflected from them so that they wither. Whoever cuts down a fruit-bearing tree is flogged. This penalty is imposed not only for cutting it down during a siege, whenever a fruit-yielding tree is cut down with destructive intent, flogging is incurred. It may be cut down, however, if it causes damage to other trees or to a field belonging to another man, or if its value for other purposes is greater. The law forbids only wanton destruction. Not only one who cuts down trees, but also one who smashes household goods, tears clothes, demolishes a building, stops up a stream, or destroys article of food with destructive intent, transgresses the commandment, 'You must not destroy.' Such a person is not flogged, but is administered a disciplinary beating imposed by the I don't know what the difference between flogging and disciplinary. We don't actually do any beating. But I think that the value here is that when you affect the natural environment around you with this kind of destruction, you are affecting the whole system, and you must be held accountable. And last, Martin Buber actually brings back, and this is in the modern era, a spirituality related to the environment when he writes that, "I can contemplate a tree. I can accept it as a picture. I can feel it as a movement. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can overcome its unique and form so rigorously that I can recognize it only as an expression of law. I can dissolve it into a number, into a pure relation between numbers, and externalize it. Throughout all of this, the tree remains my object, and it has in its time span, its kind and condition. But it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into the relation, and the tree ceases to be an it." And at the core of all of the Jewish teachings that I want to offer you today is this idea that we cannot be in an I-it relationship with the natural world. It is not an object for us to use and abuse, that we are in an I I-thou relationship with the universe, which is that we are all in it together, and that trees and animals, the zebra and the fern, that when we say Adonai is one, that God is one, it means that we are all part of the same whole. And when we hurt and destroy the other, we are also hurting and destroying ourselves. So this year at High Holidays, I'm going to be speaking about this topic, and one of the things I ordered are reusable the sporks with the spoon on one end and the fork, and it says live your values, and every person is going to get one who comes to High Holidays with the challenge: can you use this all year? And one of the things that we did at our congregation this year is we bought plastic for all of our gatherings, hard plastic, and what I'm telling the congregation is that we should still be using this plastic in 500 years for our community dinners and Oneg Shabbats, because that's how long it'll last. The only reason to use plastic is if you plan to use it for the next 500 years. Mm. And that's why you want to bring it into your community.
Thank you very much. So what I'll do now is kind of go through what Sam has to say about the creation and the environment. So I guess before I speak to that, I wanted to start with our perspective on the story of creation of Adam and Eve. And so when the second chapter of the Quran, the first chapter is more like, it's like the Muslim version of the Lord's Prayer. The first chapter is very short, and the second chapter is the longest chapter. It's over 60 pages or over 40 pages. So in the second chapter, in the first few pages, there's the story of creation. It's basically our version of Genesis. And it's interesting in that the first verse of it starts with a prologue. It's not really the creation of Adam, but it's more of a conversation between God and the angels. And I know we had the sessions on the angels with the rabbi and our Jewish friend.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, yes. And so in our belief, the angels do not have free will, whereas mankind has free will. Mankind is created from clay, and angels are created from light, are beings of light. And so God is having this conversation with the angels, and he says, I'm going to place on the earth, so the earth exists, I'm going to place on the earth a khalifa. And khalifa in Arabic translates to representative or successor or steward. These are all different translations of that and shades of translation. And so the angels, they say, well, why? Because aren't they going to cause corruption and suffering, and aren't they going to spill blood and do all of these things, because we know that they're going to have free will in this, so they can commit wrong and they can commit evil. And God says, I know what you do not know, and I have knowledge that you do not have. And so then he shows them, and he teaches Adam, he creates Adam, and then he teaches Adam the names of all things. He teaches him knowledge. So he shows that Adam is able to learn, and he shows that Adam has free will and his ability to learn, and the angels do not have that. And so then it moves on to the story of the tree, and Adam eating from the tree, that Satan caused him to slip. That's literally the word that is used, that Satan caused him to slip. And Adam eats from the tree, and then he seeks forgiveness from God. God teaches him the words to use to seek that forgiveness. And then after that, Adam and Satan, both, and Eve, are sent to earth. And so in Islam, the story of Adam's fall from paradise was not as a punishment, but as something that God had planned all along to do. And as soon as Adam made his mistake of eating from the tree that was forbidden, and then seeking forgiveness from that, he was now ready to go to earth. Because he would make mistakes on earth, and he would be required to repent and seek forgiveness for his mistakes on earth. And so Adam was ready for earth once he had committed that mistake. And so that puts into perspective that the earth, there was a purpose behind going to earth, and that Adam would be Adam and his offspring would be, Adam and Eve and their offspring would be stewards of God on earth. And so what does that actually end up meaning? There's this idea in our faith that life is a trust, that our bodies are a trust from God, and that we have to utilize them in the best of ways and take care of them. And that also goes for the world around us, that we will be held accountable for what we do to the world around us. And that on the day of judgment, our bodies will be a witness for us. And so the Quran says that the tongue will speak, and the hands will speak, and the feet will speak, and the eyes will speak, and the ears will speak as to what was seen and what was heard and what was said and what was spoken, what was done, where we went with our feet, and so on. And so being this steward, it comes with some accountability. Any steward of anything will have that accountability. The other concept I want to discuss, so first the concept was stewardship. And the second concept is the idea that nature and the world around us is a sign from God. Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said, "The earth is a mosque for me, for my people, and a means for purification." So there's this idea that the whole earth is sacred, that we don't need to specifically go to a mosque to pray, but we could pray anywhere on God's earth. So it becomes sacred, therefore. The Quran talks about the creation of the heavens and the earth as a sign. There's a special supplication in the Quran at the end of chapter 3. "O Creator of the heavens and the earth, you have not created this world in vain without purpose." So there's this supplication that this world around us has purpose. "Do you not observe that God sends down rain from the sky so that in the morning the earth becomes green?" And so we know all about that in Washington, especially on the west side. And so the rain is a metaphor for God's mercy. It's a metaphor for God's revelation, in that he sends revelation and it brings back to life the hearts that have become dry and dead. And so the revelation brings that back to life. And if you were to ask any Muslim, what is a Muslim's favorite color? They will say green. That is the Muslim's favorite color. And that is the color of paradise, is green. The word used in Arabic for paradise is Jannah. And Jannah is also, it comes from a similar root as jinn. Jinn that are hidden from view. And so the connection there is like, well, what's the connection between that? The connection there is that in Jannah, in paradise, there is so much foliage and so much greenery that the ground is hidden. And the second thing is that no eye has ever seen it, and no mind has ever imagined what it could be, what God's paradise is like. Another belief that we have is that nature worships God. In chapter 22, "Unto God prostrates whoever is in the heavens and the earth. The sun prostrates, the moon prostrates, the stars prostrate, the mountains prostrate, and the trees and the beasts all worship God." The Prophet Muhammad, he said, "Do not take any living being as a target. Whoever kills a sparrow or anything bigger without a just cause, God will hold them accountable on the Day of Judgment." And they asked, "Well, what is just cause?" And he said, "For nourishment and not for sport," and then to discard. So how can we fulfill our stewardship? The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that a believer who plants a tree or sows a field, and a bird, a human, or an animal eats from it, that it shall be counted as charity from them. And if someone has a seed in his hand or her hand, and doomsday comes, meaning the world is going to end, that they should still plant it. So that is a sign of hope in God, in God's mercy, in God's forgiveness, in the idea of, no matter what the context and circumstances, to still do whatever good you can. And then there's this idea that mankind can earn God's wrath when they ignore the signs. God says in the Quran, Allah says that corruption is apparent in the heavens and the earth because of what mankind has done. So when oil spills happen, and when pollution happens, and when all these things that we see today, it is from what mankind has wrought, from what the hands and feet of mankind have committed, the crimes that have been committed. And so when they turn away from God's signs, they spread corruption upon the earth, and they destroy farms and children. They destroy their legacy. God will not look at the person who withholds extra water and will say to him, for her. I withhold my grace from you as you withheld the excess of what you did not create. You didn't create that water. You didn't create that nature, that environment, but you destroyed it. You withheld it. A man used too much water to perform his ablution, his wash before his prayer. And Muhammad said to him, "What is this? Why, what is this extravagance?" And the man said, "Isn't this good for me to use so much water and to really purify myself?" And Muhammad replied that even if you were on the banks of a flowing river, you should be careful with the extravagance of this. And so these are all examples of teachings that existed 1,400 years ago, planting trees, saving water. And these are things that we can practice today. In our mosque, we started placing compost bins and recycling bins everywhere, making sure we had those. In Ramadan, many mosques waste a lot of water because people obviously haven't been fasting all day. If you attended my session yesterday about Islam, they've been fasting all day and they're thirsty. The mosque usually hands out all of these plastic water bottles. And so we just banned that. Mm-hmm. And we said everyone should bring their own water bottle. And you would think with hundreds of people that might not work, but it actually did work. And people were bringing their own water bottles as a result. So just trying to implement these small practices throughout our congregation and building up and increasing that every year. And actually one of the people that was the biggest advocate for making sure that there was compost bins everywhere in every corner of the mosque was a 16-year-old girl who was leading the charge there and was inspiring us to be advocates for the environment. And for all the merits of the system that exists and the market system and the capitalist system, it has also failed in many ways, failed to price the effect of itself on the world around us. So I personally am for a progressive carbon tax and dividend, and for the pricing of the use of the resources that we have, and for pricing environmental impact. So with that said, thank you. Let's finish there.
So I just want to have us look for a minute. I know we're in a beautiful place. This is beautiful, right? This is beautiful. This is beautiful.
And it's green.
It is green. This is beautiful.
That's deception pass.
So I grew up in a part of Eastern Washington. It didn't have mountains, but it had lots of wheat. So there was a kind of respect for the earth and what it can do. But of course, everyone at that point had been pretty much focused on chemicalized, industrialized agriculture. I remember sitting in Sunday school in the second pew, oak pew, of Southern Lutheran Church, and hearing the creation story. And the way I heard it, I'm not sure if it was the way they said it, is that the earth was perfect, and then Adam and Eve sinned, and then came death and destruction, and the earth is ruined. And so are people. And so what was going to happen is that God sent Jesus to forgive people. And if it was a movie theme, movie preview would be, "Jesus is coming soon to get you out of here." Like Rambo, you know, going back after the folk, Vietnam, you know, shoot them up and pull out the good people in the helicopter, right? And so the earth is ruined, is what I heard. And that God wants us, God sent Jesus a rescue person to get us out of here. And then as the story kept going, and we eventually began to talk about the end of the world. and how Jesus is not only going to come and get us out of here, but if it was a movie theme, a movie preview would be, Jesus is coming to destroy a world near you. And of course, that's the story. And so the earth is a rental unit slated for destruction, so whack away, because it doesn't matter if you spill water on the floor, because it's all coming down. And I remember how yucky that felt. Sitting there in the room, and I remember also kind of a sense of license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So we're just kind of here for a while, and God's going to get us out of here to our, what my Sunday school teacher called our true home, which is in heaven after you die. And then as I went to worship, this is what I began to read, right? We would pray this in the older version. You know, our parent, father, mother, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done where?
On earth.
Haven't we already given that up, Sunday school teacher? I mean, isn't that already foreclosed on? I mean, isn't that just like, what are we talking about? Like, now you want me to do the impossible. Like, get over yourself. Like, this does not make any sense. This feels like a setup for failure, right? On earth as it is in heaven. Wow. Like, that's, God is desiring heaven on earth. And then, of course, you know, as I'm thinking about the Lord's Prayer and thinking about what my sister and brother said here, give us this day our daily bread, which is not the same thing as give us this day, you know, Amazon Prime Days. Or give us this day everything that is in Costco. I go to Costco, too. And so there's something about, and it's, of course, as I said the other day, it's give us this day. And who's the us? Is it just people? Is it just Christians? Hope not. Is it all of life on the planet? And then our daily bread, of course, is somewhat limited. It is not licensed to do whatever you want to use all the resources and externalize the cost, as we are doing in our market economy. And then, of course, we have to recognize in the prayer that the way the environment is being used and then abused through the externalization of waste products impacts some communities more than others, typically along lines of race. And so this prayer, I mean, we pray it every Sunday, but I wonder if we recognize, like, how powerful it is in this conversation about the environment. So there is something about our daily bread, which is to God, is encouraging. God says, I want to meet your needs. And that you're a part of meeting other people's needs. And that you have to hold your needs in tension with other people. When, in fact, we have a society that says, as we talked about the other day, that idolizes the market economy as our primary meaning system, that says that you're a winner and righteous the more you produce and consume. And so therefore, purchasing of items and having a lot of stuff or having a lot of wealth is like a sign of your righteousness. And not having enough is a sign that you are a sinner. So that's just, I think this prayer says more than we think it does about this. So I was talking to, at a dinner table, with one of my favorite theologians, Douglas John Hall, and a friend of mine named Red Birchfield, who some of you may know, set me up and said, you know, Professor Hall, And I was terrified of this man, because I adored him, right? So I was sitting next to him, and Red says, hey, Terry, Professor, Terry has a great idea to talk about the Creed. He has a great summary of the Creed. And so I gulped, and I said that the creation is so beautiful, God wanted to become a part of it. And Douglas John Hall, to my lasting joy, said, yay, verily. So the idea behind the incarnation is not that Christians have privilege over people of other religious or traditions or wisdom traditions because we got God and they don't. The point of it for Christians is to say that the creation is good, and in fact so good, that God wished to join it because it is beautiful, and to join it to bring it healing. The same water that flowed in the hills of Nazareth flowed in Jesus' veins. He ate the bread that the rain and the sun and the soil and the hands of people grew by the grace of God in the soil down in the valley. And his body was made up of the olive oil that was used to break the bread. So the Word became flesh and lived among us. It's not among us, right? It's the Word became flesh because the creation is good and so beautiful that the Creator wishes to join it. And as Asa Lee helped me this morning, if I can quote him right, and tell me, brother, if I don't, is that sometimes Christians get confused because we don't separate the mission of God to bring healing in the Roman Empire, which is a little bit different than the mission of God in Jesus to bring healing to the whole creation. And we sometimes confuse those two in a way that confuses us. And of course, in Romans, we know that Paul says the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains, recognizing the way in which the domination system of Rome, which decided that everything was an it, and every person was an it, and could be consumed and controlled and colonized. Of course, it is sad to note that the Roman Empire's theology soon became the theology of Christianity and came down to me through my Sunday school teachers telling me that the earth was ruined and all we could hope for is for Jesus to come and Rambo us out of here. But that's not the vision of the book of Revelation. And so could we just read this together? Then I saw a new heaven
and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away tears from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. And the one who is seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. But also he said, write this. For these words are trustworthy and true.
So Bishop N.T. Wright, biblical scholar, says that the vision in the Christian scriptures is that we have been invited in the Christian community into this new earth, into this making all things new. It's not a different earth, right? It's a renewed earth, really. Everything we do is working toward the newness that God promises, so that everything we do can be a way to participate in the renewing of the earth that will one day be culminated and will one day come true. And so even in this time of ecological despair, a part of faith is trusting that that vision of healing and wholeness is going to happen, and that we can change our behaviors and change our policies and change our minds and our hearts to recognize that our meaning, the very meaning of our life, is building toward this promise of God for a renewed heaven and earth. And so where is heaven? It is here. Where is God? So a new heaven is a new understanding, maybe a way to say it is a new vision of who God is and what God's up to. And a renewed earth, of course. So this is from the Catacombs of Rome. And what you notice in a lot of this art and early art up in for like centuries is that Jesus wasn't depicted on a cross. He was depicted as being in a renewed earth, in a garden, with sheep and goats. And there, I think they're mostly sheep, but I think there's a goat there too. And you notice that the two trees, and so you've got all the birds of the air in the mustard plants, and the birds of the air are all the people of the world. And so this is the vision of the early community. And I think we, as in the Abrahamic tradition, need to remember that there are really just only a couple of teachings. One is that there is one God, and that we're invited to love that God above everything, so that when things don't represent love, we can let them go. That God created all the creation, and it is all beautiful. That we're called to work for the well-being of our neighbor, even as we love ourselves. And then I think a third, which we need to state more clearly, is to manage economy equitably within the limits of sustainable ecosystem, because this is beautiful. So friends, let's have some conversation now.
Text from Revelations to be delightful, because the imagery of the bride and groom and the reunification is very prominent in Judaism. And actually, every Friday night when we gather for Sabbath to allow the earth a day of rest and renewal and a day for ourselves, one of the songs we sing is Lecha Dodi, which means, come my dear friends. It's actually an invitation to the congregation. Come my friends, come my beloved, let's gather to join, to welcome in the Sabbath. And the imagery is of the bride and the groom reuniting. So that reunification within the Jewish context is something that happens on every Sabbath. And so we have a day of rest. And Shabbat, Sabbath, is supposed to be 1/60th of the world to come. So it's supposed to be a little taste of heaven every single week, that we get to experience that. And it's supposed to inspire us then to create, you know, when we're not experiencing Sabbath, to work for the sustainability and the peace and the justice of this planet here on Earth. Since Judaism is not otherworldly, even though we clearly have concepts of heaven and the tradition, the afterlife is almost never discussed. It's just not a topic. You will just never hear about it, because it's just so not our focus. The focus is the here and now. And when people ask me about what happens after you die, I just basically say, well, you know, in Judaism and Jewish history, we've had reincarnation, collective soul, Messiah, resurrection of the dead. We've had it all. Basically, we don't know. And so that's what we just don't know.
Thank you. Terry, I really like how, I don't know if vulnerable is the right word, but you're sharing stories from your history, like from your growing up. And being able to get out of that is so difficult, because you feel like you you have such an affinity towards where you grew up and the people that raised you and the people that spent time with you. I mean, I remember my Sunday school teacher. I love the guy. Yeah, like he was a great guy. And so to be able to come out of that and say, well, actually there was something, you know, I think differently now, or I'm using my own ability to think that God has given me to say, well, actually there's something else to this that you were missing. And that takes that's a huge step, and it shows evolution of thought and the idea that we can apply our own thoughts to revelation. And that's part of what God has taught us to do. In the Quran, God talks about the idea that there are people who need to reflect on this and people who need to deduce from it and not take it as this is it, but take it as a principle to then be reapplied based on time and place. And so I think that's, you're acting that out, I think, as well. And, and I was surprised at how close it was when I was using the word steward. I didn't see your slides beforehand, and I saw you say steward, and I'm like, oh, that's my word. so it's crazy how much overlap and parallel there is. I think that's pretty awesome.
I mean, I love how, again, how evocative, I said this the other day, how evocative the examples both of you use. You know, and part of the thing I encounter about Christianity in encountering rabbis and imams is just how complicated Christianity is. I mean, we got liturgies and songs and this and that, you know, centuries of theologians but I just love how those simple stories like evoke like imagination. You know, not just about the specific topic in the story, but imagination about how that might work out in many other parts of my life. And of course, I was told, one of the things I was told is that our Jewish friends are legalistic. Right? And because a lot of times, and I'll speak for Lutherans, have a very distorted sense of what law is. We don't really dug into what the term law means in the New Testament very much. And it's used in a couple of different ways. But we pile them all kind of together in a way that's not helpful. But what we're talking about is being concrete. It's a concrete example that then leads us to say, well, when I face concrete issues in my own existence and the ethics of living out love in my life, like that, those stories help me to go, oh, wait a minute, you know. And so I just so appreciate that. That again, in both of your traditions, in slightly different ways, there is a sense of self-imposed or even God-inspired limit to our own behavior. And I think that there is something about Christian history, the way theology has been developed in the Christian history, that tells us to believe in perpetual and everlasting growth, and that theology got kind of transcribed onto our market economy. That there could be forever growth without limit, without cost. And of course, that's a lie. And so I just really appreciate what both of you had to share. Are there any questions or comments? We'll try to keep them brief so we get a number in, but we welcome at this time anything you might have to say to your friends.
Thanks. I worked as an organizational psychologist for many years, and one of my mentors had this notion that all learning, all organizational learning, is trial and error. And so when you talked about, when you talked about, I never knew this, that the Quran talks about God not just giving us free will, but that the Adam and Eve lesson was a lesson in trial and error. Mm-hmm. And the learning that comes from that trial and error was like, wow, I never had thought of it that way. If I'm getting it correctly, and the implications then, in terms of the environment, the question I would put to you and everyone here is, so we have this trial, which is the climate crisis, right? We've made some errors. What's the learning? What are we going to learn out of this when we hopefully, you know, solve it? And my hope is that the learning is what you all have been talking about, which is the complete connectedness of everyone. We live in this world right now that is very disconnected and tribalizing, particularly in this country, and disconnecting in a lot of ways. And I think the opportunity here is to learn that connectedness. That's what this trial is bringing to us. And I'm just curious if I got it right, though, in terms of what the Quran is saying.
I think you answered your own question. I think we have to learn from our errors, and we have to keep going and try to fix whatever damage we've done.
Yeah, I think it's trial and error, like you said. Yeah.
Sure.
I was struck by, yes, those of you who were here yesterday, right? Yesterday? When was it? Two days ago. Okay.
Experiencing holding time.
Yeah. I don't remember what day it is, but when Rabbi Yohanna told the story about the sticks from Numbers and why that was, that you're gathering sticks on the Sabbath when other people aren't, it's against the rules, and how we were talking about it related to the economy, you know, but it's so applicable to the environment question as well. And I just was thinking about how the daily bread, you know, how that you could focus on so many different words in that, but the daily part is very much related to the story about manna, and I think also the sticks, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not good for the earth, for creation, for us to be, you know, hoarding and getting more than, you know, can be sustained. And anyway, it's a comment, not a question, but I just was thinking of the stick story.
We were in that agreement, and then we pulled out of that agreement, right? So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the other countries are,
right,
you know, part of that now, and we're the ones that are picking up sticks.
Right, exactly. There you go.
Right.
Yep.
Could you review the story? Because I think that happened before we got here.
With the sticks?
The stick picker rapper story? Oh, the stick picker rapper story? Yeah, there's a story in Numbers. It's a very short story, but it's always upsetting when we get to it, our Torah study, where they're in the desert and they've been told not to work on the Sabbath. And one guy decides that he's going to go and collect sticks on the Sabbath, firewood, a resource, a precious resource. And the people notice, and they bring him to Moses and Aaron, and his punishment is death by stoning. Wow. And it's always a really difficult story to get through. But for me, the underlying value of that story was that he was taking advantage, that he was collecting resources, and, you know, on a day when no one else was, because he was trying to take advantage and get advantage by hoarding and collecting natural resources when the rest of the community was not. And I will say that, you know, I struggle with the legalism of Judaism, where our community, we identify as not only post-halachic, meaning post-legal. We don't necessarily, we say that the Jewish law has a vote but not a veto, because we're constantly evolving. We're also post-patriarchal as a congregation, and so being post-patriarchal means letting go of a lot of those rules that establish the patriarchy. And so, but at the same time, there's a value to rules and laws because they're about what connects us. When we all agree to live a certain way for the good of all, that's sustainable. And I think a lot of Jewish legalism had to do with sustainability of the community, that we're all going to agree to live a certain way so that we can maintain, so we can sustain as a community. I think some of that thinking is very helpful now in thinking about sustaining our planet, and that rules can actually unite us, that humanity needs to have rules in relationship to the planet. We need to have a world religion in relationship to the planet that we all agree upon so that we can all continue to have a home.
Thank you for that.
I find it interesting you mentioned that there's this perception that Judaism is very legalistic. Because, you know, we are like, because we're Christians, we are the New Testament, we've evolved beyond the law. But what I'm really loving this week is all the use of Midrash in all of these forums. And, you know, Judaism has Midrash. Christianity does not really have anything quite like that. which is so much beyond the law. You know, so I just wanted to thank you for bringing those examples in. They're really beautiful and really enriched the text for me. So.
And just a real quick primer. So there is reference to the instruction, the teaching of the Hebrew Scripture in the Christian Scriptures. So I personally never called the Hebrew Scripture anything. I don't use the OT words. Like, I just don't use that. Mm-hmm. Right? It's the Hebrew Scripture, and it only, like, we're borrowing it when we teach, right? But it still belongs to our Jewish neighbors. So in the New Testament, there's two words for law. One's for instruction, and one is kind of using a metaphor for the oppressive system of the Roman Empire that sought to make everything an it, and that to be human was to have dominance over other people, and to have dominance over the creation. And sadly, the very Christian Scriptures, following Jesus' life and teaching and every example. Was that we don't have to live this way. When Jesus announced the reign of God, he was saying we do not have to live in this story. We can live in God's story. The Romans can still be here, but we can still live in God's story. The Romans may be able to kill us, but we can still live in God's story, and God, you know, and there's life after all that. And sadly, Christianity, I think, largely has soaked in that domination theology from the Roman Empire, and then that got taken away from Christianity. God kind of got removed from it, and now we have a market economy in which business people will say that it is their right to exploit the environment. It is their right to exploit their workers, because that's all that matters. That's the story they're living in. That is the religion of our time. And so Jeff Bezos recently said, I don't mean to pick on him only, but he said, I couldn't think of any way to spend all my winnings except to do space exploration.
Oh,
all of his winnings.
Yeah.
While, you know, people who work in the warehouses are getting $15 an hour, which is better than the 11 they had before, but they're still not getting all the breaks they need, right? So there is that domination system has gotten separated from God, and I think what our traditions can offer, and what we can offer with our lives, is living out of a different narrative, a different story that is moving toward the healing of all creation, and not to it, just to the exploitation of all of the its.
I was struck by the story by you, Adam, when you said the 16-year-old is the one that me, you know, sure, everybody, there was recycling bins and things in your synagogue. And so thinking about our youth and thinking about our role of faith institutions in teaching our youth, we talk a lot about vocation in my church. So what ideas do your different traditions have about teaching vocations that are different than the kinds of vocations that a generation ago we were pushing our kids into? Because we were teaching them to do the exploitation, right? Like engineering and all those things. It doesn't have to be exploitation, but often it is. So what are these new vocations where we can care for the earth? Like, you know, think about all the volunteers at Holden, right? Like, think how much time they spend, you know, going through garbology and doing all of those things. Like, what vocations can our youth do to care for the earth that maybe even don't exist now? Anybody care to share that with you?
That's a powerful question. I think since a lot of my congregation is immigrants, and immigrants like stability, because a lot of times they come from lands that are not that stable, and so they prefer those kind of safe professions for their children. But there's a huge movement in my community to get our youth into the media, journalism, and you can probably tell why. journalism and the social kind of sciences and the law. That's really important to us right now as a community. But most of our kids are still going to UW and studying computer science right now because of just this craze, obviously, that exists in the Seattle area, unfortunately. But that young girl, Sabrine, she's doing environmentalism. That's her thing. You know, she wants to go into that And I said, environmental lawyer, you know, because of the same profession, right, that's always there. And she said, no, just straight environmental lawyer. She, like, defeated me. I was like, oh, okay. I was just wondering, you know, so that's, I mean, she has that fire within her. And, you know, people are like, oh, you'd make a great lawyer because you're always arguing with people. And she's like, no. I just focused, and it's coming from her. And I think empowering them to have that is really great. And I think it starts with her parents. I think, of course, it starts with the parents, and trying to just plant those seeds. One thing we're doing is so we started in my last sermon that I gave on racism. We started a diversity committee that's going to be focusing on that, an anti-racism campaign, and then next week. My sermon, it's my turn again, and I'll be talking about civic engagement, and then I'll be creating a group of youth that want to be civically involved, because we have a lot of partners, praise be to God, we have a lot of partners in the government now and in the city, and so whenever they have, they kind of are like, well, we have the Muslim community's support in government, like when it comes to the polls, and now we have an ask, and we're like, can you give us a spot for our kids to come and be involved? And that's kind of our ask. And now I'm thinking, based on your question, I should do one on the environment, and I should have an environmental committee as well. We already have one of those. We call it Maps Now. So it's nature, the outdoors, and the wilderness. I think that's kind of our committee that's focused on that.
But also remember that every vocation, or many vocations, can live out the larger vocation, because it's the Abrahamic tradition's claim is that care for creation as a part of creation, which again, we get confused around that too. We think that we're separate from creation life. We got to be careful around that language, I think. That we're a part of creation, responsible for caring for all of it. That is part of the meaning of our life, and there can be no human meaning apart from that, no matter what profession or avocation we have.
I think for me personally, it isn't always the what, it's more the how. So depending on the job, I've got a college degree, I've got a vocational degree as well, and I've done things with my hands as well as my mind, but in the job I'm in presently, thinking of an office environment where we just instilled recycling in the last couple weeks in a very large architectural firm that does big structures. We talk a talk, but I recently got hired there. But just the what and the how are two different things. And being the you. Terry, you kind of broke it down to really simplistic of the how and the loving your neighbor, and I think in there lies a lot of the truth, but the what isn't always the important part for me, it's the how. Yeah.
So we live in this capitalist market-based economy where it seems everything's focused on these short-term profits, and they often I just don't understand why, like, the executives of oil companies can, you know, hire climate-denying scientists to push their agenda to keep drilling oil wells and pollute the air. And I think about, they must have kids and stuff, and what do they think, where their kids are going to live? And is it just that they have so much money that they're going to live in a gated community where they won't be affected by the rest of the world? And how do we get? I mean, there are external costs that they're not accounting for anymore. And how do we make a change of that?
So, what they think is either A, denial, or B, it's that they're going to live in a bunker, you know, supplied by all their wealth.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of concern amongst the very wealthy about the condition of the earth as well, and a sense of despair about what it is. But what we as Western, a lot of us here in this room are very influenced by kind of Western individualism. And we have a tendency to think, well, how could that individual do that? But remember that, like, we talk about racism is intrapersonal, it's in me, it's interpersonal, it's between, you know, us and each other. It's institutional and it's structural. So there is a spirit, is some of the language talked in the New Testament, that organizations have a spirit. right, that can be exploitative, that can be living out a narrative of domination. And then you get a lot of institutions pulling together, and you get national narratives pulling together, and you got images of what the ideal human being is pulling together, and people will end up doing all kinds of terrible things. Out of the reflection on the Holocaust, I mean, part of it was that a lot of the people that were doing it, participating in it, did not set out to do evil, but that the system, they were part of a larger structure and system and institutions that told them it was okay. And so a lot of this is like bigger than the individual, which is why it's up to all of us to mobilize not only our own personal lives and our own economic lives, but to be on the streets and to be out in public, to challenge that story, because I believe that the larger culture is tiring of the religion that is destroying us. Yes. And so we have something else to offer together.
I also had, I think there were, what you said kind of reminds me of the concept of NIMBY. You're not in my backyard. Like, I'm okay with affordable housing as long as it's not happening around where I live. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm okay with, I think that this idea that if I don't do it, then someone else will as well. I think that exists, right? Like, if Exxon doesn't do it, then, well, they're the same company, ExxonMobil now, but if Exxon doesn't do it, then Shell will do it, you know. It's kind of, if they don't do it, then BP is going to do it. Mm-hmm. So we might as well do it until the law changes to reflect it. I think that's kind of what we're seeing. I think changing individual, I think we have to move on to the next part of our session.
But what's happened is that we've lived in an economy that where picking up sticks has become the norm, and now there's no more sticks, yeah. Right? Yeah. Okay, so I want to make sure that now we all stand up for a second while Amber and Carol prepare. And then we'll start engaging about what we might kind of think about doing about this.
Right back into our topic here,
about the environment. I wanted to just say just a wee bit about Faith Action Network, because we really haven't said a thing yet about that. And we're going to have a session on Friday at 10:30, where we'll be talking more about that. But I wanted to say that I'm actually a retired Lutheran pastor. I mean, I'm not really retired, but you know, I don't have a parish anymore. And I was part of the Lutheran Public Policy Office of Washington State for a number of years and was chair of that also. And about 9 years ago, the Lutheran Public Policy Office of Washington State and the Washington Association of Churches, we were both deeply involved in public policy advocacy on the state level around justice issues and environmental issues. And our context, though, was increasingly interfaith. And we realized we really wanted to do advocacy in an interfaith way. And certainly that the values that drove us as Christians to be advocates for justice were, as we have been hearing for the last two sessions, were shared by, not only Jews and Muslims, but, Buddhists, Sikhs, and others. So it was in 2011 that we formed the Faith Action Network, initially as that we were forming it as two Christian organizations, but with a conscious intention to become interfaith, which we have, and we have an interfaith board. And you can hear more about that on Friday, or you can talk to Amber or I if you want, if you're not going to be here, and learn more about our work. But just one more thing about that, which is that the old interfaith model of dialogue between often pastor, imam, and a rabbi was kind of, you share ideas and texts and you do that, the kind of head thing. And action wasn't so much part of it. What we're finding in Faith Action Network, and not only working on public policy, but doing a lot of solidarity activity of standing with neighbors when their communities are threatened by violence or whatever, is that we start with action together, and then we end up learning about each other, and we even end up sometimes worshiping together. So it's like the other way.
Right.
And after seeing 9 years of this, almost, or 8 years, the relationships fuel deeper and deeper understanding, but the relationships often start around action. So what we're going to do now, same kind of thing if you were here on Monday. We've heard about a vision of creation, of a renewed creation out of the traditions that that have been presented to us. The current reality that we experience is something quite different. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to brainstorm. And you can see on Monday we used the wrong pen. So we have a pink board on one half. But so what we want to do is brainstorm. And I would put this, you could say we are in an ecological crisis. We've heard a vision of a renewed creation. Then we have what we have now. So instead of having whole paragraph explanations, if you could try to say a dimension of the current ecological crisis in a sentence or even a few words. And we're going to put that up. Then I'll tell you what we're going to do after that. We're going to break into small groups, talk about which are most concerning to us, how that relates to our faith values, and then what are some public policy issues that people are working on to address and change those realities. That's where we're going. Okay, so let's start. Ecological crisis, name something. Yes?
Plastics,
okay.
Acidification of the oceans.
Acidification of the oceans.
Global warming,
yes.
Race.
Yeah.
Monocropping.
Species dying,
species extinction.
Water shortage.
Deforestation.
Right now.
There was one that didn't get up there, I think. What?
And I'm very bad spelling.
Deforestation, species extinction.
So plant species as well. You know,
okay.
Loss of the
plants and animals. Yep. Okay. Others.
Difference between STEM education and STEAM education.
Okay. STEM education and STEAM education.
The energy crisis.
The energy crisis. Okay.
Pardon?
Fracking.
Okay.
Refugees and migration.
Great.
Population growth.
I'll put one up there about disproportionate impact on communities of color and on impoverished people.
I'll say asthma, which is like air pollution.
Overpopulation.
How about development or urban sprawl?
Okay. Urban development, urban sprawl. Mm-hmm. Yes,
what about like prioritizing convenience, even if it's detrimental to your environment?
Okay. Yeah, convenience, yeah.
Say like lead poisoning, yeah, water. Yes. Lead,
okay.
What up there?
Okay, maybe we have, do we have enough? Everybody have something up there?
Privatization.
Privatization.
Water.
Okay, related to water. Yeah, the water.
Water, yeah.
Privatizing basic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so Amber's going to lead us into the groups.
Okay. So we have quite a list here of the current realities, and it can feel like a lot. Like, that's a lot. And I honestly think that's kind of part of the purpose, is to create something that is a lot to feel overwhelming. And so what I'm really encouraged by is our traditions, that they give us an alternative vision for something different, and also like our responsibility to move us in that direction. So what we're going to be doing, we're going to do a similar model to what we did on Monday. We're going to break into small groups. There are three questions we're going to focus on. And we're going to be doing the first two. So from the list we created just now, really try to focus on one or two things that are really speaking to you. And then from that, really, what did you hear today, or what have you been hearing from your faith tradition that is really urging you to address those particular issues? So we're going to spend some time on those, but we really want you to start to focus on this third question, because this is kind of the path to getting us to that alternative vision, is looking at what are some policy changes at the local, state, and federal levels that give us an alternative to what we have listed here. What will get us to, you know, a world where we are entering restoration and healing? So really, we're going to have this, why we're doing it in groups, because it can be really difficult to move from the world as is to the world as how it should be. So really be thinking about, what are you hearing in particular? You know, we're hearing about, you know, clean energy practices. We're hearing about, you know, protecting our water and like policies around that. So kind of be brainstorming together what that would look like. And again, so I just want to kind of take us in with a quote, just because I really do want us to think of vision. We can get really stuck in how overwhelming things can be. We can get really stuck when we see that things aren't working right now. But I want you to dream a little, so I just want to share this quote before we break from Donella Meadows. It says, "A vision articulates a future that someone deeply wants and does it so clearly and compellingly that it summons up the energy, agreement, sympathy, political will, creativity, resources, or whatever to make that vision happen." So, like, let's take what we learned today from our traditions and let's start envisioning something different. And then let's talk about how we can do that at the policy level. So, anything else that we should add before they break?
Just three or four person groups, three or four people, and we're going to give you about
the better light.
Better light. We can't wait.
7 minutes. We're going to have to
close. Pull it into the light of the sun.
So three or four person groups, and we're going to give you probably, I think we can give maybe even 20 minutes today. We have.
Yeah.
Does that sound good? And then we want to hear back from you about number three, really, is what we want to hear back. And we're going to make a second column, not in sync this time.
Yeah, do the right mark.
Do you want to bring my group? Oh, sure. Hey, I was going to take a picture of the list, just so I have it. I'll be right back.
Because there's no other thing.
I think it's always worthwhile. And for,
And at the same time would say, God promised Noah that there would never be a flood again. So God's got the, God's controlling the temperature of the earth, right? And so it's so people will say that, Satan, both of those at the same time. They'll say, oh, well, God's in control. But it'd be better if we just, if God, if Jesus came and killed all the Jews and rejected in Israel, and then we could all go to heaven except for the billions of Jews. I mean, they will say that in the same sense. Like,
so it's a strange combination of very secular, very cynical, very selfish hopes, along with others who just believe.
For them, it's like, oh, welcome death and welcome death to life.
Why not just take care of the beautiful planet that we never had.
So policy-wise, species, I'm thinking of all the money regulations.
But does education really help when you have these notions of, no, let doomsday come because that would be important then.
I mean, at least they put a lot of law on aspects of their lifetime, like, and they can just bring that to their community. I mean, like,
reserve energy, how can we, you know, incentivize that and get more people involved in doing that at a legislative level? So tax credit. For instance, my church right now, we're in this process of trying to get a roof to, use more of the sun.
Solar.
Yes, thank you. How can we, incentivize that to kind of get more people interested in participating in that way? We also talked about a policy in Washington State around farmers markets, so supporting local farmers and not having, this constant transportation of, food and resources to allow more people to participate in that. Folks who have WIC or SNAP have some of their SNAP dollars or WIC coupons matched, so you get to actually utilize resources in farmers markets, which is really neat. So those are a couple examples that we came up with.
We had a couple others, but let's hear some more.
Yeah.
Go ahead. As far as the incentivization, plastics, the recycling of plastics occurs, but not the recycling of all the plastics. So is there a way we can establish a policy to either incentivize the recycling or using all the plastics, not just some of them, or a policy that as a corporation, you can't use certain plastics because they can't be recycled.
I think we also talked about the responsible bin. Lisa was here, she had to go to pick up Matt. We talked about the importance of corporations being responsible for what they produce, right?
Exactly.
Anissa also talked about the fact that we need to be thinking about and bringing up all the true costs of our consumptions. Mm-hmm. The example she gave of blueberries in winter, the cost of transportation, and really thinking about knowing what our consumption is. And then the amendment, the 14th Amendment, the corporation being
having the rights of personhood that needs to be addressed.
So can I see if I paraphrase, because this is, I mean, I'm putting big words in your mouth, but some ways people talk about it is corporations bearing the cost of the waste. And for example, in our state, in Washington State, yeah. The whole e-waste thing that corporations have to bear by law some responsibility for recycling electronics and so forth. So would that be an example of that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Costco, all the plastics they generate, mm-hmm. do they so, take so, those back?
So true cost. Yeah. Okay.
But one thing on the plastic recycling. There's got to be new ways because mm-hmm. China is not accepting almost all of the plastic anymore. So where does it go? It sits at Costco and it goes into the landfills. So there's really no plastic, or a very small amount of plastic recycling going on these days.
There's this small town in Guatemala that completely did away with plastic. No plastic can enter San Pedro.
So that's what we
might use to be.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, and even small steps. Again, these are steps that we are taking to get towards this vision. Like a lot of cities have, banned plastic bags. You're seeing a lot. You know, and of course, you know, people still have them, but we're trying to do that at the state level. So it's these small steps too to get us closer.
My city has Everett, no longer.
Tacoma, mm-hmm. Seattle. Yeah.
Portland.
Yeah.
One of the federal policies that can help to address climate change is the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act.
Yeah.
It's introduced in the House. It has about 70 co-sponsors.
But not adopted.
Energy Dividend and
Energy Innovation.
Oh, Innovation.
And Carbon Dividend Act. This puts a price on carbon. Returns the money to the people. It's a really important step. It doesn't completely solve this problem, but it gets us on a path that we can solve.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we were, struck by something that Adam said when he talked about vocation, mm-hmm. communications, and law. And Dana took another step, and how do we get to the colleges that mm-hmm. really start to change the curriculums, that it's not just about going out and having a vocation that makes a lot of money, mm-hmm. but there's now this piece to it, like what is your impact to the environment? So one example of that could be a graphic designer who's out there making packaging in the world, that there needs to be an equation in that it's like, what is the energy that's used to bring it to market, and then what happens when it leaves market?
Absolutely.
Right, so that now there's other accountabilities that are
and that's exciting because they're, I mean, in a lot of other fields as well, there are ways that like the state is trying to, increase certain professions out of college. So I know with like psychiatric care in Washington, you know, there's been some legislation to try, how do we get more people in the field? So kind of starting to think about how we can legislatively do something to encourage colleges. Yeah.
Just to pick up a little bit more on that, the idea also might be to use Holden Village as a forum for bring together people who are creating curriculum in law or environment or whatever, yes. and coming here to, in a sense, overcome the adversarial relationship between business and, mm-hmm. and environment,
yeah.
and have an exchange going on here with people who are thinking about what kind of curriculum are you going to create for a law student or an mm-hmm. environmental engineer or whatever.
There is that business model that includes the environmental and social costs as part of the equation of that, you know, so it's really, yeah.
Yes, yeah. It's not just a money
cost. In that regard, could there be a policy that in order to sell something, you had to at least file a total energy budget for the product from cradle to grave. Mm-hmm. That would at least tend to itemize all the things associated with that as far as energy goes. In other words, it takes energy to produce it. It takes energy to distribute it. It takes energy to dispose of it.
Yeah.
This would be like a product?
It would be like a what?
Like a product that was brought to market.
Yeah. Right, right.
Just like we now have all the ingredients on our...
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you mean on the label, you mean kind of thing like that?
Good, yeah.
Up here, did anybody have anything? Yeah?
Yeah, we have a really great conversation in our group. You know, we talked a bit about urban planning and how that can play a role. Talk about some cities kind of around the world, not really in the States yet, that have worked on license plates and like what your license plate number being, meaning that you can't drive on certain days of the week, so like odd numbers can't drive on like half the days or something. And then we also talked about other aspects of urban planning, like automobile-free zones of cities, widening bike lanes and bus lanes, and improving public transit and how that can help kind of reshape urban environments. And then we also talked about the resource tax that Adam was talking about and how that can really appeal to our kind of economically focused society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something too that like, I've never, like I haven't thought this real way, but I was kind of brainstorming up here. It's just this idea of like, if there was a public-private partnership around like the work schedule and when people go to work, and so it wasn't such that like Monday through Friday 9 to 5 is when everyone works, but instead that like maybe there are shifts and opportunities to work that accommodate more for childcare and then also like lessen traffic flow from this time to this time, so people aren't sitting in their cars as long and the CO2 emissions are like accumulating, and then people can be more efficient in their timing and we're not like spending an hour and a half commuting from Chicago to Seattle. It would be like maybe some shifts are from like 6 to 11 and at a store, at a company, but it would have to be this public-private partnership and strategy to like increase what I think would be like access to like childcare or like family model and support, but also like it could improve some of the traffic and congestion.
I love that. Ooh, Adam, and then we'll kind of wrap up.
I'm a little embarrassed because I spoke for so long, but I just so passionate about this topic.
No, go for it.
I know yesterday there was someone who said, you know, I'm just so jaded about that because what can we really do? And it feels like we've just been going in a circle about a lot of things. And I was thinking back to, did you guys hear about the South African water crisis?
Yes.
Anybody hear about that? And so basically South Africa, the scientists said that, look, by 2020, we're going to run out of water. We're not going to have any more water for most of our population. And so as a society, South Africans got together and they were saving water everywhere. And as a result, they were able to push that deadline a year. And then they kept doing it, but they didn't stop even though the deadline got pushed. And they did it again. And then it eventually just became, okay, well, we don't have a crisis anymore if we keep up this level of water usage. And so I think as a society, having post deadlines is important. That gives us like a goal and an objective, and just pricing that and realizing what that is for us, I think that's important.
Well, and are you going to share our legislative success this year in Washington State? We have a
last one. Just one more, yeah. That is, look to California, the Bay Area, even Los Angeles, although not as much, but they are traffic jam after traffic jam, and Silicon Valley now, almost all the big companies now subsidize their employees for their mass transit costs.
Yeah.
And so everybody takes the commuter trains and stuff down there. Companies are offering for free to their employees either all free commuting, or that they actually have little buses that go around that pick up employees at the train station or wherever they, you know, or some, you know, hub for car transportation, and they're subsidizing the employees to take mass transit. And, you know, I come from Portland, but, you know, we're getting, and so the city fathers are saying, well, let's just put an extra lane on here. It's like, no, we need to add extra buses or tracks or whatever. So if we can influence our own local administration to say this is stupid, let's look at LA, you know, that, and the Bay Area to say, hey, even though they expand and they got, you know, they got a billion of cars down there, you know, they are doing something right out of necessity.
Yeah.
So
all right, so I know this. I feel like we're getting better each time. All right, so I'm going to just share close this out with a couple examples of interfaith work around the environment that has led to some success. So I'm going to share two really quick ones. So there's an organization called Blessed Tomorrow, and it's an interfaith kind of movement that organizes people, meeting them where they are in their understanding around the environment and climate, and their goal is to reduce the impact of climate change on our society, right? So they have an array of resources. I'd encourage you all to look them up. They're really great. But an array of resources. They hold webinars. They give like individual ideas for faith communities to reduce their energy usage and waste practices. And they also share successes of things that work. And I think that that's super needed.
Say the name of it again. I'll write it up here.
Yeah, sure. It's called Blessed Tomorrow. I think it's blessedtomorrow.org, I believe, but if you Google it. But they have really good resources on messaging. So when we're talking to other people in our faith communities or, you know, our communities at large, like how do we talk about it, the climate crisis from our faith values and our traditions? But they, like I said, they mentioned successes. I think we need to constantly remind ourselves that things are happening, as Adam mentioned, in South Africa, right? So one of the recent ones is the United Church of Christ. We just had our General Synod, and as a denomination, we came together and very publicly, and we'll continue to be very public about it, but endorsed the Green New Deal and the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. So as a denomination, as people of faith, we came together and said, these are important policies, and these are before Congress, and we're going to take a stand as a denomination. So it was really encouraging for me for folks to really speak up from their traditions and actually take a stand on public policy. Washington State, just this year, and Faith Action Network was really involved in it, was involved in the passage of the 100% Clean Electricity Act. So that's Senate Bill 5116, which will rid Washington State's electric grid of fossil fuels by 2045. We also passed some several orca protection bills, so that's a big deal right now in Washington to kind of help that species community thrive. And we also, we didn't get this passed, but we got a budget proviso, and it's called the HEAL Act, and it's really looking at health inequities in the environment, the relationship it has to the environment. So these things are happening, and it might feel small, it might be slow, but it's important to remind ourselves that success and coming together in interfaith work can make a difference. If you have anything else to add, I kind of would like to just read a little tidbit from this letter. So as I mentioned on Monday, there was a campaign called American Values, Religious Voices. And this one is really particular to the climate situation in our world. So it's by Forrest Klingerman, an associate professor of religion and philosophy at Ohio Northern University. And this is addressed to President Trump, Vice President Pence, the Trump administration, and the 115th Congress. So I just want to read a piece of it. So the beauty and fecundity of the landscape we call home is ingrained in our national consciousness and celebrated as God's glorious handiwork. From sea to shining sea, from the Berkshires to the Sierras, from the great black swamp of my part of Ohio to Washington's Potomac watershed, our natural world is considered a blessing. We are living in a wonderful and divine book of nature. Yet our economy and politics are laying siege to the environment. These are not problems affecting somewhere else at some other time. Environmental crises are happening here and now, disproportionately affecting the most vulnerable members of our society. Our actions do violence against our human and non-human neighbors and threaten the entire divinely ordered cosmos. He then goes on to kind of describe some of the things that we've been kind of removing ourselves from. Furthermore, your administration proposed funding cuts for scientific monitoring and environmental research, and you have cut curves aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Assessments like the EPA's climate change indicators in the United States shows how climate change is already affecting health, safety, the environment, and the economy. Denial of this reality is neither intellectually nor ethically acceptable. Trust in God requires us to face the truth, however terrifying or inopportune it may be to our plans and our priorities or in our politics. Faith in God means living in hope, working towards what the theologian David Clem and ethicist William Schweiker called the integrity of life before God. On Earth Day, let us vow to mend our ways and atone for our climate sins. With a sense of hope, let us take seriously our roles as stewards of the world once deemed very good.
Wow.
Thank you all for staying and for your work, which...